Zarqawi. A year after the invasion, I got together with General Jay Garner, the guy who had been our kind of pasha, the first guy that we put in charge, that the president put in charge of Iraq. Anyway, I want to take you back to April 27th, 2003, if you want to know about Mr. Zarqawi. April 27, 2003, call comes in from Washington, D.C. to Saddam's palace. It's ours now, the Saddam Hilton. General Jay Garner's ensconced in the bedroom, gets a call. It's Rumsfeld. He'd just arrived hours before into Baghdad. Just arrived. And Rumsfeld says to Garner, you know, in so many words, "Don't unpack, Jack. You're out." And then they savaged this guy in the press. Now, what had he done? Apparently, and the reason I talked to him is that I got a hold of this, okay? I know that the president and the prime minister of Britain have said that there was no plan whatsoever for the oil fields of Iraq before the invasion. Conspiracy theories, they called it. Of a plan, that Bush had a plan for the oil fields of Iraq before we invaded. And he actually didn't. He had two plans. But BBC said, you better go authenticate this. Just because the brown envelope tells you that there's a secret plan doesn't mean that, you know, you better go. So I went to General Garner. Three stars, that's good enough for me. Said, "You recognize this?" He says, "Oh yeah." See, what happened was, Garner made a mistake. See, the president had made a speech, appointed Jay Garner, and said that we were bringing democracy to Iraq. They'd be in charge of their own destiny. Democracy to Iraq. So Garner got off the plane in Kuwait, and just as he was about to head off into Baghdad, said, "Yep, democracy, we're going to have elections within 90 days. On that, he said, "You know what we're going to do?" They asked about the oil. He said, "It's their country." And he added, "And it's their oil." And got a call from Rumsfeld. Bye. See, because the plan says it may be their country and their oil, but see, the elections and democracy, they didn't want that confused with elections. And see, because the plan, Annex D of the plan, it's 101 pages long, and Annex D required 270 days to sell off all state assets, including privatization of concessions and leases and management contracts of all state assets, which in Iraq is just about to came, especially those in the oil and supporting industries, especially the oil. But you can't do that in 90 days. You need 270 days. You can't elect, because no elected Iraqi government is going to let you sell off their oil, or our oil, which is under their sand, right? Garner made a mistake. I said, "So why didn't you impose this plan?" He said, "Well, he told me he thought that the plan, economy plan for Iraq, for the occupation, he said, should be about gathering the harvest, because they're facing starvation, getting the water moving, the electricity turned on. Instead, 101 pages, you should read this thing, it has an income tax cut for the rich of Iraq. A cap on corporate taxes. Foreign corporate taxes. Expansion of the copyright laws so that we would no longer be threatened by Baptist copies of Britney Spears' Baby Just One More Time." Or dubs of Windows, Microsoft Windows. It was a Christmas tree for corporate America, it looked like. Who came up with this? Looks like a lot of work it went into it, but whose work, you know? there's something about it that smelled. And I smelled Grover Norquist. Now, Norquist is the capo di capi of corporate lobbyists of America. Every Wednesday, he gets his whole team together, the Christian Coalition and the National Rifle Association. And he represented Microsoft. And he represented American Express, etc. So actually, I went to see Grover. And at his K Street offices, lobby offices. And I said, Grover, what about this appendix, 270 days? What about the elections? He said, and he showed me the copyright law changes. And he showed me the sell-off of the banks and the income tax cuts. And he said, certain things precede elections. Certain things. Like page 73, the oil. And see, what had happened was, there was no Zarqawi. They weren't throwing flowers, but they had gotten together, the Iraqis, under what Garner called the big tent. He had called them together. Kurds, who knew him for 4 years in the northern zone, where he had brought peace by bringing factions together. The Sunnis, the Shiites, they knew him. And they were ready to take control of their country, hold snap elections, and Garner called for removing American troops out of the cities and out of Iraq into the empty desert. It's their country, he said. Let them choose their leaders. Rumsfeld had a better idea. He held an election too. First, they removed Garner, and they brought in someone who is much more experienced, not in Iraq, never seen Iraq, but they brought in Paul Jerry Bremer, who is much more experienced because he was the managing director of Kissinger Associates. And so they had an election. One voter, Jerry Bremer, appointed the entire government himself. Order one, de-Baathification, which meant, in effect, de-Sunnification. All Sunnis out the door. But in case the Shiites thought that they were going to be in charge, he shut down Shiite newspapers, shut down their mosques, moved troops into Najaf. Some Shiites got upset and shot back. And then, when the Sunnis were removed of all their work and all their jobs, a Sunni from Jordan named Zarqawi said, "We're going after the Shiite snakes." And Garner said, "Let's get them under the tent and talk." But the president wouldn't talk to him. Instead, he got out and said, "Bring them on." See, you can't have a war president without a war. On a lighter note, let me show you CNN's balls. The balls that they put on the air after the Ohio vote, after the polls closed at 1:05 a.m. on November 3rd, 2004, early in the morning. Polls are closed. These are exit polls asking people who they voted for. And as you see, John Kerry, this is a screenshot that was saved from CNN. John Kerry won among men 51-49%, but among women, Bush lost 47-53%. So Bush was declared the winner. Okay. Well, I was reporting for BBC Television, and I'm looking at the numbers, so I, reporting the news, declared the winner. I said, John Kerry won. We had a very long investigative story explaining why Kerry won. And you saw that on your news, right? It was in the New York Times, right? You saw that. They did call me. They called me. They said, "We're investigating theories that Bush didn't win the election." Okay, great. Glad you're on it. They're investigating New York Times on the case. So I said, "Yeah, I have a lot of information if you want." He said, "No, we want to ask you a couple questions." I said, "Shoot. First, are you a sore loser? And the second question, are you a conspiracy nut. I'm often called a conspiracy nut, which always gets, you know, a laugh from the conspirators. And the third question, well, there was no third question. That was the end of the New York Times interview, and the investigation of the election of 2004 was now complete. The next day, they wrote, I'm not kidding you, they wrote a front page New York Times story. I can't say they ignored the story, and this is the headline. Internet theories of Bush loss spread by blogs, easily debunked. Well, since the New York Times didn't have a chance to complete the investigation, I thought I would, for BBC, working with Voter Action. And so I went back to the balls. And so I thought, okay, Kerry wins among men by 2%, among women by 6%. What is the third sex class that put Bush over the top? And the answer, as it turns out, is the disappeared. The votes that disappeared. Officially, according to Ken Blackwell, Secretary of State of Ohio, 1 George W. Bush won the state of Ohio by 118,000 votes. Not like Kate Harris's 537. 118,000 votes. There you go. Not counting a third of a million votes cast and not counted and votes blocked. 137,127 votes cast and not counted. That ain't nothing. See, we've gone a little Ohio crazy. Let me explain the nasty secret of American democracy. In the year 2004, 3,600,380 ballots were cast and not counted. Not in the United States of America, not the Ukraine, not Uganda. 3.5 million votes. I didn't get this from my black helicopter, okay? I used to teach statistics, and like I said, I worked, you know, with Milton Friedman, and I went into the raw data of the Election Information Agency in the U.S. Census. It's reported there. It's sitting there, as I want to tell the New York Times. It's waiting for you, you know? It's waiting for you, okay? Where are these from? 3.5 million votes. What happened? They're in two big piles. One pile is something called spoiled ballots. It's one term used in the vote biz, spoiled. 1,389,231 spoiled ballots. Now, how do ballots spoil? I mean, leave them out of the fridge? Or no, hanging chads. They hung around from 2000. They kind of multiplied. Hanging chads, lots of them. Punch cards that don't punch. Touch screens that just don't feel like you know how to touch them anymore. In other words, glitches and paper that just, paper ballots that just crumpled, whatever. Glitches, machine glitches. But whose glitches? See, not everyone's ballot glitches the same. That's where the statistics came in. Me and statisticians working with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission and at Ohio State, Cleveland State, we looked at the numbers. And golly gee, look at the electoral dumpster. Where are the votes glitched? If you look at the white precincts, let me show you this little chart here. If you can see, it's also in the book, it'll be easier. Little white lozenge. That's white precinct votes that get glitched, not counted. And this big, thick black line, that's African-American voters probability that their vote will be lost to a glitch. If you're black, the chance your vote will be lost is 900% higher than if you are white. If you're Hispanic, 500% higher than if you're a white voter. If you're a Native American, about 2,000% higher than if you're white. If you do the numbers, simple arithmetic, 88% of all the votes in the 3.5 million pile garbage can of votes are cast by voters of color. 88%, almost 9 out of 10. Now, I don't know who they voted for. And I'm not saying it's deliberate. Or maybe I am. But I was invited by Holly Jacobson and Voter Action. Your people here decided to do something very smart. Not just investigate 2004, but I decided to investigate 2008. And what that means is, where are they going next? They are going west, young man. Florida to Ohio. The new demographic, Hispanics, moving west. Holly Jacobson and her crew invited me to New Mexico. And I thought, what a great idea. What happened there is that in New Mexico, George Bush won by 5,988 votes. And who am I to disagree? But as long as you don't count the 34,000 ballots left uncounted, unopened, untouched. But whose votes are these? We don't know. Except that we noticed that I went to Taos Precinct 13. That's known as the Taos Pueblo. And there are precincts in Native country all over the West where as few as 1 in 10 Natives cast a ballot for president, chose a president. I don't mean that they blew off the race. I mean that they got in their pickup truck or their ponies or whatever they do, and they showed up at the polls, they waited in line an hour, they went into the polling booth, and they didn't pick a president, and they walked out. That's what the machines say. So I decided to go to Taos Precinct 13 and find out about this. This is massive, like Indian Indecision Day all over the West. Wow. Like maybe a protest or some boycott. So I go in and at the Pueblo and meet with a guy who is, his title is War Chief. Okay, and I say, okay, Chief, so you Indians can't make up your mind? You don't know who to pick for president? And the War Chief said, listen, we know who to pick for president, but we don't pick the machines. And he added something. He said, we trusted them. They came in with the machines and we trusted them. Raises some questions about his knowledge of history, but okay. See, we don't give them blankets with smallpox. We just give them the old Shootronics machines. So the Republicans know this in advance? Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Florida, Ohio, of New Florida, as they call it, wrote to the Republican head of the Senate there before the election, if we don't change the punch card machines, we're going to have a Florida-like calamity in the minority districts. Now, it was not a warning, it was a boast. The ACLU saw what was happening and said, change the machines before the election. This was nearly a year before the election. And Blackwell said, sue me, which they did. And he went to the court and he said, as soon as the trial is over, yes, we are going to change those machines. We'll have the hearings mid-November 2004, 2 weeks after the election. So that's what you had. You had the man in charge of counting the vote, who's also the co-chairman of the Bush for re-election campaign, which is interesting. I mean, in most countries you're not allowed to wear two hats unless you have two heads, so I'm going to check that one out. But don't worry, he's not going to be Secretary of State anymore. He's running for governor, but he'll stay in office long enough to count his own votes this November. But that wouldn't have been enough to do it for George in Ohio, or New Mexico, or Iowa, or we don't know yet how many states. There's a second big old pile of votes. Votes rejected. Voter votes and the ballots rejected. And a special type of the biggest pile of rejections were in something called provisional ballots. What is that? That's a brand new flavor of voter created for 2004. It was a reaction to what happened in 2000. I did the report for BBC television, showing that just before the election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush ordered the removal of, it turns out, a total of 94,000 voters from the voter roll. 94,000. But for good reason. They were all felons. Of course, their only crime, apparently, for the majority, was voting while black. It's okay. Jeb actually signed a consent decree with the NAACP, apologized, and said he'd never do it again. He did that a year after the election and before he did it again. But the Congressional Black Caucus got a tape of my broadcast from the BBC, and they played it before the caucus, and they went in enraged and demanded of the Republican Democratic leadership that there be a provision that if you show up at the voting at your voting station and your name is not on the list, you've been purged or expunged, that you still get a ballot provisionally. And if you are a legal voter, if you're a person who has a right to vote, then your ballot gets counted. And then something strange happened. Karl Rove said, "Great idea." Now that was a signal to some of us. And we ought to reconsider, look more closely. But the president signed the provisional ballot into law in the 2002 Help Americans Vote Act. Now, when George Bush tells us he's going to help us vote, immediately I get concerned, but you know, and sure enough. See, because the president signed the law requiring that all provisional ballots, that you be given a provisional ballot, but there is no provision that the ballot be counted. And that was left up to each Secretary of State, Mr. Blackwell, Ms. Harris. How many provisional ballots? Congressional Black Caucus said, well, looking at the purges, and we stopped the purges, so, you know, maybe we'll get a few thousand ballots. 3 million voters in 2004. 3 million voters were, completely unreported in the U.S. press. 3 million voters, this is the official number, were shunted to provisional ballots. And 1,090,729 voters' ballots were thrown in the garbage. 1.1 million ballots cast, thrown in the garbage. Were these illegal voters? You know, it's a crime. It's a felony in every state in the country to vote illegally. What a crime wave. 1 million people voting who had no right to vote. So I called up all these attorney generals. How many people you bust? Well, none. Florida said, how many cases you got? They said, 6. You mean you brought charges against 6? No, I said, we're looking at 6 cases, but we haven't brought them. A crime that didn't happen, but 1.1 million people punished for it. Which 1.1 million? Any guesses? 88%, right? 88%. But the question was, 3 million? How do you get 3 million provisional voters? That means that someone had to challenge these voters, purge them, challenge them. How could this have possibly happened? And then in my computer, I started getting some emails. They weren't actually addressed to me. We had worked with a website called georgebush.org. And see, there was communications between the chairman of the Republican Party state committees and the Tim Griffin, who is the chief political operative and research director of the Republican National Committee. talking top honchos, sending emails back and forth. And attached to these emails were lists of voters. In fact, see, all their names were in the domain georgewbush.com. And then someone on one email put .org, and we were able to get them all. But, you know, we had to look, what the heck is this? It was like a bunch of names and addresses. But why would the very top level people in the party have a bunch of names and addresses of voters? I mean, you're talking, we had like 70,000 names, and we had to go through these. And we were like, leery. I mean, this is like insane effort to match these names and addresses with maps and demographics. And sure enough, almost every single voter, except for 2%, 98% were in African-American majority precincts. Now, what the heck was this? Experts told us what they thought it was. BBC said, you know, we don't know what this could, you could have been set up, is always one of our fears, and we have to authenticate it. Like when I had the contracts showing that the black folk were deliberately purged in Florida, one way we confirm, we just go to the people whose documents it is, and they say, explain it. And, you know, when I was in Florida, and I showed the Catherine Harris's voting director the purge list, and I wanted to ask him about it, and he just, you know, ripped the microphone off and ran to his office, slammed the door, and called the state police to remove me. BBC took that as a confirmation that it was his. But I thought, well, maybe he just had another appointment. There's big smokies coming. Come on. So we took our cameras to RNC National Headquarters in Washington, got the door slammed in our face. We went down to Florida to the state party chairman there, and they put out their PR flack, Mindy Tucker Fletcher. And I said, missing something? There, I mean, I have hundreds of these, right? Hundreds of pages. So, oh, it says caging. Caging lists, spreadsheets. Oh, caging list. Republican Party donors. It's a donor. Okay. And I went through several pages of men in homeless shelters. I said, a lot of donors in the men's shelters, you know, thankful for the opportunity to sleep out in the open air. Okay. We had another idea. This was a challenge list, a secret list to challenge voters on election day, maybe before. So now, remember, if they're challenged, then they go to the provisional ballot. Now, these are not felon voters. These are in all these states. They were not felon voters. They were voters with suspect addresses. So what's so suspect about these guys? We looked at, like this list here, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, all the way down, Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, on and on, pages and pages and pages of African American airmen and sailors and soldiers. We called one, Randy Prousa. His wife answered, he's not here. Where is he? Well, he's been shipped overseas. The Republican Party had mailed letters first class to all these black soldiers and men in homeless shelters who would be registered there. And they wrote on each of the letters, do not forward. And when the letters came back, they had evidence of a suspect address. That person ain't there. We know that every guy on this list ain't there. They're in Baghdad. Now, I just want to explain, in case you're wondering, it is not illegal for a soldier to vote from under a Humvee in Fallujah for President of the United States. Even a black soldier is allowed to vote. But the mass challenge, the huge mass challenge of voters on Election Day, was a virtually unreported story in the United States. And the deliberate aspect, the caging list, was completely unreported in the United States, except on we put this on the top of the BBC Nightly News, by the way, top of the Nightly News worldwide, the world's biggest network, Not one word from an American network, except for ABC Network. I'll give them credit. They had a little story on their website saying that there was a false report being disseminated by BBC television about Republicans attempting to remove voters. And their source, by the way, was Mindy Tucker Fletcher. But you know, one of the questions, why didn't they, besides the fact that maybe they shouldn't do that to soldiers, why didn't they say that they were challenging voters? Remember, 2% of the voters, by the way, were not African Americans. They were the majority Jewish precincts in the retirement communities in Florida, which is also a Democratic demographic. So they kind of went after the elderly of Zion as well. You know. But see, there's a problem with that. It's called the law. 1965 Voting Rights Act made it a crime, a jail time, hard time crime, to target groups of voters for challenges or interference in their right to vote in any manner, even if you have some excuse, you suspect their address. It's against the law if race or religion is part of your program. So that's why they kept the secret. Of course, they say, well, now we busted them. Were they going to get busted? Well, we went to the civil rights voting cop, John Ashcroft at the time. And he directed us to his press spokesman, Mindy Tucker Fletcher. So you just, you know, I showed you the plan. Page 73, privatization, especially in the oil and supporting industries. They didn't privatize or sell off the oil fields because democracy reigned. No, I was wondering what happened. What force is more powerful than gopher nose twists and his corporate roster? And then after 2 years, I gotta tell you, 2 years of grueling research by the team, we found, got something 323 pages long, the plan that was put in effect that they denied in writing over and over again didn't exist. And this was a page from it. I smell Baker. James Baker. James, in fact, the particular one, James Baker the Third. Now, the Third, in case you don't know who he is an attorney who is better known as the consigliere to the Bush family in the Republican Party, the guy who boasted, in fact, in front of a BBC reporter, I'm the guy that fixed the election for George Bush in Florida. He was the lawyer for Bush v. Gore. He was kidding, of course. Senior counsel to Carlyle Group, lawyer for ExxonMobil Corporation, and he's a lawyer in the September 11th lawsuit. As you know, the families of the victims of September 11th have sued the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for funding Al-Qaeda because Osama and Zarqawi don't put this stuff on their credit cards. The money came from the Arabian Peninsula. So the kingdom was sued as an accomplice. And James Baker, of course, represents the Saudis against the families of the victims. And of course, his main office is the center of our government, Houston. But he also has a satellite office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He actually has, James Baker represents the Saudi government, ExxonMobil. Carlyle Group has an office, not even Dick Cheney has an office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It's true. And I called the White House about this. They said, well, you know, in fact, sometimes he works at the president's desk in the Oval Office while the president plays on the rug. I made that last one up. He does have the office at the White House, right in the White House. He's not just a person, he's an institute, the James Baker III Institute, where his operations, the big political operations, are run. So I talked to a few oil company guys who later, when I published some of this in Harper's that you'll see in our meta, you know, they told me that this plan was crafted by James Baker's people in Houston, even though their name is not on it. It says, you know, U.S. State Department. So this document, probably shouldn't read to you because it said, I can't read to you because it says contents confidential, should not be reproduced, distributed, or publicly released. I'll show it to you anyway. What is it that Baker III, his institute, Exxon, Saudis, what is it that they wanted? The key to the whole thing was to create a system in Iraq, an oil company, a state oil company, and a state oil ministry. The purpose was to enhance a government, they meant Iraq governments, enhance the Iraq government's relationship with OPEC. What's that about? First of all, OPEC is the organization of petroleum exporting countries. It's otherwise known as the oil cartel. It's otherwise known in legal circles as a conspiracy against trade. It's a felony organization. It's a gang, a mob. If they did it in the United States, they'd be doing hard time on a chain gang. But there is an exception to U.S. law, which, by the way, has a provision in which U.S. law extends our antitrust reach, as does other nations' laws, because cartels to fix prices, and that's what they do. That's what OPEC is, an organization for fixing prices by limiting the supply of oil. But there's an exception to the law, which is that if you wear a bathrobe and a crown, you're off the hook. But it is a violation of the law. If any American participates in any foreign cartel whatsoever, it's a violation of U.S. law, or takes actions which benefit that cartel against the interests of the United States. So you notice this document is confidential. Now, am I saying that enhanced relationship with OPEC suggests that James Baker, who represents Exxon and Mobil Corporation, his institute developing a plan for the United States military to occupy a nation to enhance the relationship with OPEC is an illegal conspiracy against the public from his office at the White House? I don't want to suggest that. But the question is, how do you enhance OPEC? You know, you enhance your relationship with your wife by giving her flowers. You enhance your relationship with the Lord with prayer. But how do you enhance a relationship with an oil cartel? The answer is you squeeze the supply of oil. You limit it to what OPEC quota has been set for that nation by Saudi Arabia. That's how it works. That's how you enhance your relationship. Now, why? Let me give you oil economics lesson number one. You heard I studied with Milton Friedman. Lots of international economics. And one thing I learned, real simple, the less oil, the higher the price. Rule number one. Rule number two, the less oil, the higher the price. So when oil companies go exploring, including when they use their exploration company, the 82nd Airborne, it is not, as many people have written among the progressives, to find or bring us back oil so you can fill up your Hummer cheap. Okay? It is to find the oil and turn off the spigot. The less oil, the higher the price. And that's why when people say, George has screwed up, oh, he's made a mess of it, just like he screwed up with Bring Him On, got reelected. He screwed up, the oil blew up, the pipelines blew up. Remember, we're going to get all this oil. Even Wolfowitz promised it in testimony before the United States Congress. Remember, Iraq will be free. Now, he didn't mean Iraq will be free like a democracy. He meant Iraq won't cost us a dime. What, Iraq will be free? No, you know, free ride. We can bomb them. They'll pay for the bombs with their oil. Remember? Was he lying? I spoke to the guys that gave them the information, and they said, well, we told them something else. And by the way, as a racketeering investigator, you tell someone something and they testify and say something else under oath, that's perjury. That's perjury. That's hard time. Did Wolfowitz perjure himself? He was told one thing and he testified to something else. And my publishers worried that. They say, you know, you write that and you're implying the guy committed perjury. No, he didn't. Paul Wolfowitz did not commit perjury. See, because his buddy in the State Department, Elliot Abrams, who was convicted, as was Ollie North, of perjury because they lied under oath. When Wolfowitz testified, check the record, he never raised his hand. He never raised his hand and said, I swear to tell the truth, so help me God. None of the Bush boys, when they talk about Iraq or oil, ever raise their hand. No perjury. No truth, no perjury. Now, less oil. So the deal is, Saudi Arabia sets a quota of 3 million barrels a day. That's it. That's the program. Not to get the oil. It's worse than no blood for oil. It's no oil for blood. So, wait. But this is an old story. To understand the history of this, how this happened, how this came about, it's not something new that they just came up out of Houston. It's an enforcing an old policy that goes back to the day Iraq was invented by Winston Churchill in 1920, Winston took the fields, oil fields of Kirkuk, the oil fields of Basra, and what they thought were oil fields in Baghdad, and tied them together for Anglo-Persian Corporation, now known as British Petroleum, and said, by the time he got to the bottom of his brandy bottle, you're Iraq. But they needed a king. So Britain called in Faisal. And they said, you're king of Iraq. He said, what's Iraq? He says, it has a capital in Baghdad. He says, where's Baghdad? Don't worry about it. You love it. So they brought in Faisal. He immediately gave the entire rights to all the oil of Iraq to a guy named Khalous Gulbenkian. And Khalous then, of course, turns around, as he was supposed to, and sells the rights, 95% of it. That's why he, to this day, he's still called Mr. 5%. 95% to Anglo-Persian, now British Petroleum, Standard Oil, now Exxon, James Company, Total, Royal Dutch Shell, all the big oil companies, and in the floor of a hotel room in Brussels, 1925, they spread out a big old map of the Arabian Peninsula and took a big red pen and circled Iraq and Syria. And every oil company executive signed on that red line, promising never to drill that oil. Less oil, higher the price. Okay. Oil was being discovered all over the world, and the price of oil in 25 was dropping. They promised never to drill. Now, the British Foreign Office is very nervous. You got a bunch of restless Sunni Shiites, Kurds. So, Anglo-Persian, British Petroleum. There's actually a memo, it's stunning to read this. A memo from an executive to the Foreign Office saying, don't worry, we're drilling in Iraq. Shallow wells in places where you're certain never to find oil. Continued on until 1964, when Iraq said, enough. The contracts say you got to drill, you're faking it. There's hardly any oil coming out. We got as much oil as Saudi Arabia, almost. So they expropriated, they seized the oil fields from British Petroleum and Exxon. The Prime Minister of Britain called up the President, John F. Kennedy. See, we talk about wars. Let's talk about the war that didn't happen. And he reminded Kennedy that, of course, under Eisenhower, when the Iranians nationalized the oil fields, that Mossadegh, the president, was removed with prejudice. Okay? And part of that plan, go back to those CIA memos at the National Archives. Part of the plan to bring in the Shah, they said, what we need to do is activate the fundamentalist Islamic religious organizations. to declare that an elected democracy in Iran is un-Islamic. We need to activate the mullahs. And they did so, and that created a popular uprising, removed the democratic government of Iran. And thank God that's never come back to haunt us. But when the British Prime Minister reminded Kennedy, look what we did in Iran, we got to take care of these Iraqis, same thing. And Kennedy said, the oil companies and the British government, British Petroleum and Exxon, have been stealing so much from the Iraqis for so many years that this is not an expropriation, this is justice. There was no war in Iraq, 1963. And then Kennedy's policy was suddenly changed. Now, the less oil, the higher the price. Did George screw up in Iraq? When Bill Clinton left office, oil was 20 bucks a barrel cheaper than peanut butter. Today, it's $73 a barrel. Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished. And that's why they have to kill Hugo Chavez. I'll show you. This, from inside the Department of Energy. When I showed this on BBC TV, the Department of Energy called and said, how'd you get that document? What it says is, it talks about Orinoco extra heavy oil resources. How much? Orinoco is in Venezuela, which means it's underneath Hugo Chavez. And it shows that Venezuela has a lot of oil. Five times as much oil as Saudi Arabia. Five times as much oil as Saudi Arabia. Now, I showed this to President Chavez last month when I was down in Caracas. Of course, he knew this. because if he ever wondered whether the question was whether the United States knew this, and if he ever had any doubts about that, he got the answer from the president's spiritual advisor, Reverend Robertson, Pat Robertson, said, Hugo Chavez thinks we're trying to assassinate him, and I think we should just go ahead and do it. So I talked to Chavez about that. And he said, look, I would like to make you, and he's talking on BBC television to a billion people and heads of state he knew would watch what we're saying. I will offer President Bush, Mr. Danger, as he calls him, I'll offer Mr. Danger and the rest of the West, oil one-third off what you're paying now. Let's stabilize the price. The Saudis jumped the price up, and then to knock out alternatives from my heavy oil, which is expensive, to drill, to wind power, to solar power, they suddenly every 6 or 8 years dumped the price of oil to $6, $10, $12 a barrel. No alternatives. The windmills are silent. And then when there's no alternative, boom, it's back up. I said, let's cut the up down. It's killing my economy. Boom, bust. It's eating America alive and destroying the third world. Let's bring down the price of oil to a reasoned price, not too low, not too high. He said, I shook Bill Clinton's hand onto this. And now George Bush wants to chop his hand off. Why? And the answer goes back to enhancing OPEC. And what do we mean by OPEC? Every oil guy I spoke to said the same thing. OPEC is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is OPEC. What's the big deal? Our president, you know, why does our president ride around in that golf cart with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia? Well, one, he's in the golf cart because George is afraid of horses, right? But it's true. That I didn't make. He's afraid of horses. There's one single picture that we've been able to locate at BBC of George Bush on a horse, and the horse is dead, stuffed. I'm not kidding. You know, they had a picture of him, looked like he's on a horse. I'm not kidding. You pull back, and it's like he's on a... Of course, he may be on a rocking horse somewhere. We don't have that. But why is he going around in the golf cart with Abdullah? to get Abdullah's oil? Well, you know, Abdullah can't drink it. His harem can't drink it. He's going to sell it to us or somebody. He's going to put it out on the market. He doesn't want Abdullah's oil, petroleum. He's addicted to Abdullah's petrodollars. Petrodollars. Remember the film Network, right? And there's a kind of a truth-telling TV journalist who says, enough of this oil cartel. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And then this big mogul brings him into a corporate conference room and says, Mr. Beal, let me explain. The Arabs have taken billions of dollars from us. And now we must get it back. It flows out. It comes back in. It is the ebb and flow of international finance. And you're concerned with nations and people. There are no nations. There are no people. There's only Exxon and DuPont. It goes out. It comes in. It's gravity. Well, Chavez decided to defy gravity. Because, see, part of the deal was, besides cheap, stable oil, peace is one. The other, he said, I'll give you the oil, but I'm not giving you the petrodollars. Money for Venezuela stays here in Venezuela. We can't be an oil colony anymore. The last big oil boom ended with 1 million people living in cardboard shacks on the hills of Caracas. When the money came in this time, I've been there before, and this time when I returned, the same places that were cardboard shacks are now brick houses with computers in them and medical care. Okay? He said, that's what it's for, and it's for Latin America. And to make the point, he just withdrew $20 billion from the United States Federal Reserve. See, Abdullah, here's how it works. The flow, Mr. Beal. They charge $3.50 at the pump. ExxonMobil's takes a slice. The Saudis passes on to the Saudis, take a little slice. Jim Bob takes a slice and a slice. And then it comes back. $253 billion went out to the Emirates for their oil and the Arabian Peninsula. $311 billion, a third of $1 trillion, came back. Actually more, because some of Japan's money was taken and came back to the United States a little bit to try to buy the ports. But most of it, see, they're just trying to get the money back. They don't even know where to put it. Except most of it goes back in the form of purchases of U.S. Treasury bills and securities to fund George Bush's spending spree, a $2 trillion deficit, a $2 trillion increase in the national debt, 100% of it paid for by these foreign borrowings. The oil is the key. The petrodollars are the key. We don't get taxed, they say, but you are taxed. That's a tax at the pump. So that it goes out and it comes back after these guys take their slice. ExxonMobil made $10 billion every 3 months this past year. No one's seen profits like that since the Pharaohs. Exxon's reserves have grown in value since the war began by $666 billion. Two-thirds of a trillion, $666 billion. You know, mission accomplished. $2 trillion. $2 trillion. Spent supposedly stone sober. So, and Chavez takes out $20 billion from the United States Federal Reserve, cashes in his treasury bills, and lends the money to Argentina and Ecuador. So he's got a date with the bullets. So what are you going to do about it? You know, I just told you that they've caged the voters.
1.9 million voters were denied, ballots were cast in 2000, 1.9 million, and not counted. They cranked it up with provisional ballots to 3.6 million in 2004. In 2008, they're going to work it to 5 million with the new voter ID requirements. What are they going to do about it? Martin Luther King III, I was meeting with him and a bunch of civil rights leaders in Alabama, and he said, "Greg, I'm going to take your book and place it on my father's grave. And I know he'll be pleased." And it was pretty moving. But I thought, and I told him, "You're just going to get the book dirty. There's got to be some better idea." And Jesse Jackson, he really did. King said that. And Jesse Jackson said, who is sponsoring, by the way, he is another sponsor of the Armed Madhouse tour through Operation Push. He said, "Greg, we march, we win. We march down Pennsylvania Avenue, and we throw the book through the window." At the Jim Baker's office, I suppose. No, he said, "We march, we win." He said, "When we crossed the bridge in Birmingham in 64, we didn't have the vote, and we won the vote. In 72, we didn't have the peace in Vietnam, and we marched, and we won the peace." And you might say, marching doesn't make a difference. Well, I can tell you, if you don't march, it will definitely not make a difference. And he said, "And vote." And I was immediately thinking, you know, come on, they're taking the vote. What's the point? But, you know, I was thinking of being in Mexico. The point is back in Taos Precinct 13. They're not going to count their votes in the Pueblo. And they know it. They still vote. And you know what else they do? Because I got to tell you, as you well know, if you know the Native American culture, their kids go into the military. They're the ones. They are the suspect voters. Okay? And every morning at Taos Precinct 13th in the Pueblo, the natives, the veterans, raise the American flag and they salute it. And they raise the flag and they salute it, even though they know that no one's going to count their vote. You can take away their land and you can take away their resources. And you can take away their votes and you can even take away their kids to Iraq. But they'll be damned if you're going to take away their country and their flag. And that's your job. Their vote doesn't count. 5 million votes will not be counted in the 2008 election. You are going to commit tonight to bring 6 million new voters to the polls. That's what you're going to do tonight, you commit to it. And if they keep 140,000 troops in Baghdad, you will put 140,000 people in every street in America. We can do that. That's not much to ask. And there's just one thought I'm going to leave you with, that something our president said that I agree with. Yeah. Before he went into Iraq, he said, "I want to speak to the Iraqi people." And he said, "Do not fight for a dying regime. It is not worth your life." It isn't. Thank you very, very much. I'll answer your question. I'll sign books. This is all here tonight for you, for voter action, for the independent media, not the dependent media. It's for you. Thank you. See you in 2008.